The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Ruins, the 2014 Annual Conference, copyright 2014. If you have purchased this recording, you are free to make multiple copies for your school's use. You may not sell copies of the audio or post copies on the internet. Order additional conference recordings from this year's conference or previous conferences at store.accsedu.org. Find out more about the Association of Classical and Christian Schools at www.accsedu.org. Thank you.
Well, good morning, everyone. Welcome. Please take a seat. It is 9:30 and time to get started. My name is Jenny Rollins. I'm a teacher at the Ambrose School in Boise, Idaho. I've taught there for the past 6, now going on 7 years, and I'm also a graduate student researching some of the topics that we'll be discussing today. And every time I get to speak on this topic with fellow classical educators, I'm so excited because I was a classically educated student, and so was my husband, pretty much K through 12, and then on into college at New St. Andrews. And both my husband and I really feel that our affections, our hearts, truly were molded by our classical education. And so, in many ways, I'm here to give back a little, to pay a debt of gratitude to teachers like yourselves. And so, I just want to say thank you for the work that you are doing. It truly is making a difference in the lives of students like myself. And before I begin, I want to just give a quick note about the outline in your book. It's on page 38. And my talk is organized more by narrative and by story than by subject. And we will be going through, don't fear, and covering every point on the outline. But I'll do so in a more circular and storytelling fashion. And we'll circle back through the different points a couple of times. So just be aware of that as we go. So here are some of my students from my fifth grade class last year. And of course, as a good teacher, I'm responsible for teaching them many things, spelling, Latin, Shirley grammar, math, history, how to write a good topic sentence. But that's not all that I'm supposed to be teaching them as a classical teacher. I'm also supposed to be shaping their character. And we've learned from C.S. Lewis that training affections or cultivating virtue or teaching students to love truth, beauty, and goodness and the Lord and each other is actually what education is for. And these noble goals we have listed often as our chief objectives, even on our school's websites. And Lewis says in his book on education that actually the most important thing that we're doing is shaping what students love. He says this, "Virtue is rightly ordered loves, the condition of affections in which every object is accorded that kind and degree of love which is appropriate to it. Students must be trained to feel pleasure, liking, disgust, and hatred at those things which are actually pleasant, likable, disgusting, and hateful." And the question I want to ask this morning is, how in the world do we actually do this in our lessons, in our routines, in our homework assignments? How do we actually train a student to love one thing and hate another? And Lewis goes on a few pages later to say that it's not any explanation of virtue or even list of reasons why virtue is good that will actually help a student grow in virtue or shape their heart. And instead, that it's habit-shaping practices, bodily actions that most shape the heart. This is in the quote that's actually at the top of your outline. And to me, the idea that our mission in classical education is shaping students' hearts is very inspiring. When I first started teaching at Ambrose, I was so excited that my job wasn't just to teach Latin and grammar and history, but actually to form students' characters and to change their lives. But then I realized that I'm supposed to teach Shakespeare to fifth graders, and how am I supposed to go from the daily events of my classroom and my curriculum to actually forming their affections and shaping their hearts? And this really hit home to me one year, a couple of years ago, when I was teaching my eighth grade girls a Bible study on gratitude. And here are some of my eighth grade girls from this year. I should mention, by the way, that all of my examples from this year will come only from eighth grade girls, because in seventh and eighth grade at our school, we separate genders. So the boys are in one classroom and I teach the girls. So anyway, I was teaching my eighth grade girls a couple of years ago this Bible study on gratitude, and they would come to my classroom for a period, and I would open my Bible, and we would read Bible verses, and I would teach them theological principles, and they got really good at this. They could quote Bible verses back to me, they could explain the theological underpinnings of gratitude, how it was so important in our lives, and give all these brilliant examples. But I started to notice that something was really wrong, because these same students who were so eloquent and so knowledgeable about gratitude in the classroom would walk out of my classroom and down the halls grumbling about their homework, about their teachers, about the way their hair looked that day. And what I started realizing is that in what we were doing, I was reinforcing this deadly message that said there's separation between what we talk about in the classroom and what you actually live out in your real everyday lives. And of course, that's our question this morning, is how in our classes and our assignments and other aspects of education, how can we actually form students' hearts rather than just pouring information into their heads? And after experimenting for a few years in my classrooms, it's been my experience that, like Lewis suggests, it's actually the habit-forming practices, or liturgies, as others have called them, that most shape affections. And by practices, I mean how we do what we do in the classroom, things like methods, routines, pedagogies, the form of our assignment, basically how we teach the content of our curriculum. And I want to distinguish the practices of classical Christian schools from the content, which is what we teach, things like the subject material, the books that we read. And I think a lot of the energy of classical education in the past three decades has gone into figuring out what we should teach and why. So remembering that Latin is something that we should teach and giving defenses for why we should teach it, for example. But this morning I want to direct our attention beyond the content to how we teach it. Because like Lewis says, simply having virtue in our curriculums doesn't mean our students will actually develop a love for virtue. And so my question is, how can we use our academic practices to shape our students' affections? And what are the ingredients of those practices that most powerfully shape students' hearts? And over the course of my talk this morning, I'm going to suggest that there are certain practices and liturgies which were developed by Christians for the past hundreds and even thousands of years out of medieval forms and practices from Scripture and from a serious study of God's Word and human nature, and that these practices, which were designed specifically for reaching students' hearts, can provide a good model for us as we plan our lessons and classroom practices. So Lewis's words in The Abolition of Man reminded me of meeting a girl at this very ACCS conference about 2 or 3 years ago, I think. And like me, she had been classically educated, K through 12, and she'd recently graduated from high school. And a couple of co-teachers and I asked her about her experience. We wanted her to share with us what she had gotten out of classical education. And sadly, she told us that the fruit of her experience had made her cynical, that she approached the world, because of how her teachers had taught her in her classes, to only look for worldview truth, whether it was in a Shakespeare class or a chemistry class or a Bible class. And this left her with an approach to creation and history and art as something only to be judged and evaluated and analyzed for its worldview content. Analyzing worldview truth in her life had completely outweighed loving beauty and living out goodness. And so when she encountered something like a story, all she could think about was whether or not it had a good worldview. And when she encountered something like an awe-inspiring cathedral, her instinctive response was to criticize it and say something like, well, heresy was preached here once. And though this wasn't her teacher's explicit goal, the affections that had been formed in her heart were a love for judging and being right and rational proof, and that while she'd taken Shakespeare and chemistry and Bible classes, the way she was taught those subjects actually influenced her more than the content of the lesson. And the constant emphasis on worldview at the expense of everything else had left her only with knowledge of truth and how to measure it, and no real understanding of how to live it out. And I'm not trying to say at all that truth is bad, but that the way in which we teach truth can itself be true or false, and that simply getting our students to know or think about truth is not our primary calling as teachers. More than just graduating students who have a good worldview and great critical thinking skills and good theology and reading comprehension, we want our students' lives and loves to be shaped by what happens in our classroom. We want our students to go out in the world and do things. We want them to spread the gospel and bring their friends to church and worship the Lord and create beautiful works of art and serve people. And in fact, many of our schools have goals for a graduate that list these exact things. And I think it's not the content of the curriculum, but the way in which these two graduates were taught, the form of their pedagogy, that made the difference in their experience. They could have been educated with the exact same curriculums with radically different practices. One that said the practices that said the most important thing that you learn from this lesson is how to think about architecture and the grade you get, and the other in which a student's heart was touched by the beauty that she experienced. And I think I'm so passionate about this because I'm a graduate of classical education, and I experienced this sort of heart transformation. But many of my friends and peers who were also classically educated had a very different experience, had sort of the opposite because of the way that they were taught, even though the curriculum and content was quite similar. And C.S. Lewis addresses the importance of the way that we learn to know something in Mere Christianity, and he uses an example of the Atlantic Ocean to do this. And he uses the knowing the Atlantic Ocean as a metaphor for knowing God. And so he says there are a few different ways you could go about getting knowledge of the Atlantic Ocean. First, you could read tons of books and basically find out all the facts that there are about the Atlantic Ocean. You could look at maps and study charts and diagrams and come away with this wealth of factual knowledge. But you wouldn't actually know the Atlantic Ocean until you had experienced this, until you had played in the waves and watched the tide and felt the salt breeze in your face and heard the roar of the waves, and that there's a physical and visceral type of knowledge where you come to know something by feel rather than by intellect. And I think in this example, Lewis makes it clear that how you learn about the Atlantic Ocean is the most important factor in whether you have real knowledge of the Atlantic Ocean at all. And we saw earlier that Lewis said in Abolition of Man that virtue is the result of having emotions that have been trained by habits. And I think that there are a number of ways of understanding and articulating this principle, that it's our habits that shape what our hearts love, and our hearts are touched through the practices and the physical experiences that we have. So we might say, to train affections, we should teach through experiences as well as explanations. We might also say that the way we learn something is more influential than the something that we learn, that the form of a lesson teaches as much as its content, or that the way to a person's heart is through their body. And I think liturgy is a good word to describe the methods and pedagogies and practices in our classroom, because liturgy means a habitual practice, an action or a behavior that's repeated and that subconsciously shapes us. And we can often think of liturgy as just something that happens in church, the order of worship or little routines that we go through, but I think it's not just those little things. It's also the form that we use to deliver the content of our lessons. It's the thing that structures our days, and in the end, it's what most shapes our lives. And if you think about this as a teacher, we all have liturgies of our lessons and our classrooms, even though they may be invisible to us. So think about things like, how do you review a topic? How do you assign homework? And what kind of homework do you assign? How do you assess your students? How do you begin and end your classes? And how do you spend the time? Do you spend most of the time lecturing, or are you a discussion-based teacher? Are you a crafty projects sort of teacher? And in addition to the practices of our lessons, we also all have liturgies of our classroom. Things like, how do we address our students? How do we punish and reward them and get their attention? How do we relate to them and expect them to relate to each other? Even how are our classrooms arranged, and how do we allow our students to ask questions or make comments, and what are our daily routines? And I don't think we give as much thought to these things as we do to teaching the content itself. But liturgy is so important, even though it seems like a trivial thing, because as Thomas Cranmer wrote, the mind is captive to what the will wants, and the will is captive to what the heart wants. And because our goal in classical education isn't just to teach students information, but to form their hearts, we don't want them to just know truth and goodness. We want them to live out goodness and be truthful and love beauty. And we want to shape their hearts to reach their lives. And I think this is done in part through reaching their senses. So in other words, if our goal as educators is not just right knowing or right thinking, but it's rightly ordered loves and right action, and since action requires heart engagement, and since the heart is discipled through bodily habits, I think it's our practices that are actually the part of education that most shape our students' lives. So I want to give an example of this in teaching Shakespeare to fifth graders. And this was one of my first experiences with how powerful liturgy was, the way that something was taught. And when I was first hired at Ambrose, I was just graduated from New St. Andrews, and I was all fired up about changing the world by teaching my students to love truth, beauty, and goodness. And then I got the curriculum, and I realized I'm supposed to be teaching Shakespeare unabridged to fifth graders. And I thought, how in the world am I going to get from the curricular objective of Shakespeare to our school's broader goal of heart change? How does that happen? And so I thought, well, what are my goals? Well, I do want my students to know the basic facts, and I do want them to understand the plays. But beyond that, I want them to love Shakespeare and remember Shakespeare. And even more than that, I want them to see that Shakespeare is an author who sheds light on deeply human questions, and that all great literature is a place to go for wisdom, that we need stories, that they shape us and change us and teach us how to live. And most of all, my goal in teaching Shakespeare is for my students' hearts to be changed. So if that's my goal, what form, how, what practices am I going to use to teach my students Shakespeare? Well, we could go for a broad approach and teach them a lot of facts about Shakespeare's biography and his context and the history of the globe and the plays and such, or we could go for broad exposure and read lots of different summaries of plays and abridgments, or we could take little fifth graders and have them read the actual text of the plays themselves. But thankfully at Ambrose, I inherited a liturgy of performing plays because we want our students to have an embodied experience of Shakespeare rather than just an explanation. And so here's how the liturgy goes. First, we take one play and we read it, and then the students try out, and we give them parts, we choreograph it, we block it, we build costumes and sets and props, and then we produce it on a stage with lights and sounds and an audience of about 500 people. And the experience that the students gain through this is not just a knowledge of Shakespeare and a familiarity with some of his works, but a love for Shakespeare that comes from having lived with his work and understood it deeply on the level of multiple senses and emotions. They internalize it in a way that I could never communicate if we just learned facts about Shakespeare or just read the plays in class. And through living the story and becoming the characters, this really, I found, touches students on the level of their heart. After directing Two Gentlemen of Verona a couple years ago, I woke up the next morning, it was Saturday, and I checked my email. And I'd gotten an email from one of the little 10-year-old boys who was in the play. And he wrote to me and he said, Mrs. Rollins, I'm writing to you to ask your forgiveness because I realize that I've been treating my classmates in the same deeply self-centered way that Proteus, and Proteus is the main character in Two Children of Verona, and he betrayed all of his friends and backstabbed his girlfriend and caused a lot of communal damage and heartache from that. And this little boy said, I realize that I've been acting just the same way towards my classmates. So will you forgive me, and will you pray for me, and will you help me to change? And I thought about it, and I thought, I don't really think my student would have had this experience, this heart change, if we had just covered the basic facts about Shakespeare or even just read the plays. And I think it really took the experience of Shakespeare to touch his heart that deeply. Likewise, in 7th and 8th grade, when we studied Macbeth, the question that I wanted my students to consider as we read the work was the same question posed in Matthew's Gospel. What does it profit a man if he loses his soul but gains the whole world? And I don't want them to actually have to live through Macbeth's horror to thoroughly understand the ramifications of selling your soul to gain a throne. But I also don't want it to just be a nice philosophical discussion. I want them to remember and feel the earth-shattering impact of selling your soul to gain something. And also to learn from Macbeth that great literature isn't just something to read and take a test about, but it's something beautiful and terrible, and it can reveal our own hearts to us, and it can mold us. And mostly that literature isn't about reading a work, taking a test, and getting a good grade, but literature is something that's supposed to shape what we love. And for these students, it was the experience of fencing lessons and costumes and real stage blood that was the vehicle by which they grew to understand those things. And I learned this experience, this lesson in teaching Shakespeare experientially, that this practice of producing plays really did change my students' hearts. And this made me think about liturgies and practices to train their affections in other ways. And so I came up with this idea that if there was an affection I wanted to form, rather than just teach about the principle, I would experiment with finding a practice or a liturgy that aimed at forming it. And I know this formula is a little reductionistic, but it illustrates the connection that started emerging in my classrooms between practices and students' hearts being shaped. So, for example, just one illustration of an affection that I wanted to cultivate and a practice that I thought about inculcating to cultivate that affection was, especially in a grammar school that's very rules-oriented and very structured, I want my students to understand that truth isn't just a list of propositions. Truth is the person of Jesus Christ. And that obedience to the Lord isn't just following a list of rules. It's following the example of the story of Christ's life in the gospel. And so a practice that I tried to use to cultivate this affection in them was of always using stories to explain moral questions to them. Or when I had a discipline situation, using a story from something that we were reading in class to address their sin. But something else I learned is that while it's true that experiential practices seem to shape affections, it wasn't quite as simple as, okay, I'll give my students a fun experience, and boom, their hearts will be changed. And I discovered this with many practices that went terribly wrong, and I realized that I needed a model for good academic liturgy, something to use as a measuring stick for my development of classroom practices. And after doing some research, especially in the early church and the medieval era, I found I didn't need to reinvent the wheel. There are so many incredible models of educational practices from the early church and the Middle Ages, which they built from serious study of God and Scripture and the nature of man, and which they developed specifically for the purpose of shaping affections. And this morning, I just want to share one of the most prevalent medieval liturgies for learning something, which is this three-step liturgy expressed in the metaphor of honeymaking. And this is probably the most common medieval metaphor for study and learning, and the most common template for lesson planning, if we could call it that, from the early church in the medieval era. So first, a bee flies around, as we know, and it collects nectar. Second, it digests the nectar. And then thirdly, that digestion results in the production of honey. And these three stages of honeymaking, the medieval said, correspond to the three stages by which anything is truly learned in a way that it's internalized, in a way that it can shape the heart. And they named these three stages lectio, meditatio, and compositio. In other words, first you collect from what you're learning, then you spend time digesting it, and last of all, you compose with it, both by creating external things and by living a life that is shaped by what you've been studying. So take studying Augustine, for example. So first the student would collect nectar by reading Augustine's texts. And then he would digest nectar by praying about, meditating on, commonplacing, memorizing, and discussing Augustine's texts. And then lastly, he would make honey by living the virtues in Augustine, like having rightly ordered loves of his own, and also creating his own work that organically wove Augustine into it. And another common medieval metaphor that went along with the honey-making one was the lectio meditatio compositio progression of eating. And this came from the early church's view of reading the Bible as a type of feasting on scriptures, where first you took the word in, you ingested it, but then you digested it, and finally the word made you grow. And this three-part liturgy, these three steps of practices, lectio, meditatio, and compositio, were so completely seen in the medieval era as both practices of worship in the church and of education. It's a practice that would be followed by a medieval monk in the library with Homer and then in the chapel with his Psalter. And it was completely designed to cultivate virtue by shaping affections of students who practiced it. Gregory the Great was one of the people who developed this model, and he said this about it. We ought to transform what we read within our very selves so that when our mind is stirred by what it hears, our life may concur by practicing what has been heard. And because this progression of lectio, meditatio, compositio is a liturgy that so deeply originates in Christian tradition, and it's for the purpose of training students' affections, I found that it's an incredibly fruitful model in planning both lessons and the flow of a day, an academic day, for the purpose of shaping students' affections. And so next, I just want to give a couple examples of how this model is fleshed out in my classrooms. So first I'll give one from fifth grade and then one from eighth, and hopefully you'll be able to glean from some of my mistakes and successes things that are useful for your own classrooms. So firstly, literature in fifth grade. So my first year of teaching, I begged and begged my headmaster, please let me add Lord of the Rings, all three books, in addition to The Hobbit, to our fifth grade reading list. And I made this argument to him based on the fact that Lord of the Rings is probably the best book, other than Narnia, for shaping the affections of children in a biblical way. And he said yes after much pleading. And then I started trying to think about, okay, how am I going to teach this book now? And despite the fact that I made the initial argument based on forming my students' affections, the way I actually taught Lord of the Rings didn't actually aim at what I said I wanted to do. And I came later to realize that the practices that I was using had embedded in their forms things I didn't want my students to be learning, and that I never brought my students past the collecting stage, the lectio stage, to a stage where they were digesting and then creating with Lord of the Rings. So take a look at this worksheet. This is a real worksheet that I used to give 10 and 11-year-olds once a week. Can you believe this? 40 to 50 questions for fifth graders once a week, and they had to do corrections too. And nothing is wrong with these questions per se, but when this is the majority of what we did, and our liturgy was you read the book, you find the answers to the questions in the worksheet, you turn the worksheet in, you take a test, you get a good grade on the test, and now you've mastered Lord of the Rings. The message of literature taught this way is that you read the book for information so that you can spit that information out back on a test so that you can get a good grade and feel successful about yourself and then move on. And I realized that the practices that I was using to teach Lord of the Rings undermined my goal of forming students' hearts in reading the books. I don't actually care whether my students remember the minute details of Lord of the Rings, but I do want them to cultivate a love for stories and a love for virtue in the stories. I don't want them to ever have, based on the way that I teach them, the false impression that they're finished with a piece of literature that's supposed to disciple and change them for the rest of their lives. Instead, I want them to learn the virtues of Samwise and the friendship of Legolas and Gimli and the humility of Faramir and Aragorn. But I realized that my practices were actually forming affections for obsessing about getting right answers and good grades. And I also wasn't moving past the collecting stage. I wasn't providing time to digest and an opportunity to really grow. So here's the worksheet that I came up with instead when I realized what was happening. And you can see that there are many changes. So the first thing that the students were asked to do was simply, as they were reading, just to find one passage, one beautiful, important quote to write down in their commonplace book and show it to me the next day. The next thing that they had to do each day was to write down a question to share with the whole class. And the purpose of this was to, rather than reading a book to find facts, to read a book with an interested, curious, inquisitive mind. And then lastly, they were supposed to look for great ideas like community and fellowship or faith and reason or hope and despair as we read and write examples of those down as they looked. And I also found that worksheets and assignments like this better prepared my students to go on to the stages of meditation and composition. Then in this meditatio stage, so after we had collected, after we had read from the books, I started building in time, often a whole week or even 2 weeks after we'd finished reading and commonplacing the book, to go back and have conversations and do creative projects on the book to communicate to my students that the fruit of education is creation, not regurgitation. And we also spent significant time having discussions, both while reading and after finishing the book. And rather than explain a meditatio discussion, I have a short clip of fifth graders in my classroom discussing the Lord of the Rings. And just a quick background on the clip before I play it. The question that they're discussing is, was it Sam's fault that Gollum wasn't redeemed? And it's just 5 minutes from what was a 90-minute discussion, but it's representative of the type of sort of meditation, meditatio, digestion discussions that we had. And another note is just the quotes that the students read for the sake of time have been excerpted, so you'll see them scrolling on the page next to the video. So here's a glimpse of them discussing the question, was it Sam's fault that Gollum wasn't redeemed in fifth grade?
And I have to agree with Jacob, and this is in the Fellowship of the Ring. And it's on page 58, even corrupted by the ring, because he had a will of his own, like we all do. And he denied his will and gave himself over to the ring and took the ring, kept it for himself, and started teaching himself. And started using the ring for malicious uses, and he became sharp-eyed and keen-eared for all that was hurtful.
And to follow up on that, Gollum wanted to take the ring instead of letting them have it, because he was having somewhat of an argument with himself on if he should take it or not. And he chose to take it, and that was his will, that he chose not to redeem himself.
To go against Kenny and Cole, especially Cole, saying because in that one passage that he said that Gollum wanted the ring because the gold looked so bright and beautiful. And it was that temptation that was overcoming him. And it wasn't his own choice, it was Sauron and temptation that was overcoming him.
Page 51. It's Gandalf telling Frodo about what the ring does to you. That shows that since the ring and the corruption of the ring has basically devoured Gollum, he can't think for himself.
No.
So therefore, it was the ring that made it so he couldn't be redeemed altogether.
And going on about the Communion and Fellowship, what Kendall said a while ago, how Communion and Fellowship helps with temptation. Well, Gollum and Gollum had Communion and Fellowship. Gollum was Gollum's, or Sméagol at the time, was Sméagol's best friend. And when Gollum said, no thank you, I already got you a birthday gift, that was having Communion and Fellowship with him. He had gotten him a birthday gift. He had been friends with him his whole life. And then Gollum came up behind him and strangled him because of the ring. So the ring's temptation was even over the Communion and Fellowship.
A couple other thoughts I have is to add on to Charlotte's when she read that passage about when Gollum, you know, when Sam gave Gollum one last choice. The ring, you know, the ring is its own free will. It's like none of Gollum's will. And Aragorn and Gandalf both didn't accept the ring or didn't even come near it because they knew that it would corrupt them.
So, on page 60, in the Fellowship of the Ring, Gandalf is talking. You ought to begin to understand, Frodo, after all you have heard, said Gandalf. He hated it and loved it, as he hated himself and loved himself. He could not get rid of it. He had no will left in the matter. That is saying he couldn't change his mind. Gandalf is even saying he had no will left to deny the power of the ring.
It also connects to Adam and Eve and how they had a choice to not take the fruit, but they chose to take the fruit, which made them lost in the darkness. And
in Genesis, and when Adam and Eve were tempted by the ring, and
the ring, sorry.
Adam and Eve were tempted by the ring.
Wow.
Sorry.
Adam and Eve were tempted by the serpent, Satan, and this connects to the ring power of God.
For out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. And that is actually like a total connection to the end of the Return of the King, saying here, for out of it you will return to the ground, for out of it you were taken, for dust you are, and to dust you shall return. And Gollum said at the end, when the process is destroyed, I will return to the dust, and I will be laying in the dust. Mm. And so that's
good. He didn't have anybody to comfort him and help him through those tough times. Even like Sam and Frodo. Frodo was corrupted by the ring and getting corrupted, and Sam helped him through those hard times. And Gollum didn't have anybody to care for him or help him through his little commotions with himself.
And we have, like Frodo, like Bilbo, we have the community and fellowship, not just of each other, but of God, of Jesus, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.
How they have bigger armies, the bad people, well, they don't have community and fellowship. So therefore, their armies kind of aren't worth as much as the good-sized armies because they fight within each other. And they don't really fight against the good guys, they fight against themselves.
Mm-hmm. And that we do not go and be like the evil that has no communion and fellowship and no bonds or anything, Lord. But please help us to be healed by communion and fellowship and know your wisdom and understand the wisdom that you gave through Tolkien.
So that's just a little example of a meditatu discussion where because the students read in a way where they were collecting, we were then able to spend time deeply meditating and digesting what we had read. So Lectio, collection, Meditatio, digestion, and then finally Compositio, composition, or fruit. So this third stage in teaching Lord of the Rings, where knowledge is supposed to blossom into love and bear fruit in students' lives, to attempt a final project that was a composition, what I did was I planned this fancy breakfast for Return of the King, where the students were all assigned to come dressed up as their favorite race in Middle Earth. And they also had to bring a toast that they had written for a character in the book and a reading that they had prepared to either give dramatically or to sing from the book, and also an object. One girl brought a beer bottle, and I had some explaining to do to parents when that got left in the fifth grade classroom at the end of the day. Why is there a bottle of Stella Light in your fifth grade classroom? Fortunately, it wasn't opened. Anyway, here is a quick glimpse of that final breakfast, just from my iPhone. And these four girls had chosen a passage from Return of the King and set it to music and sang it.
Now I'll sing to the sea, the wife are crying.
And of course, Compositio, the honey-making stage, is the time when what you've learned is supposed to become second nature. And it's not just about reciting a poem or a toast or dressing up, singing a song. It's living out the beautiful truths we've discussed. And of course, it would take many years of embodiment and similar practices for students' affections to be cultivated to that degree. But the amazing thing is that every year in fifth grade, parents would come up to me and say, "The students just love each other so much in your class. Why do the students get along so well in your class?" And I would say, "It's Tolkien. It's Lord of the Rings. It's learning to love each other through internalizing the community that he portrays in Fellowship of the Ring." So just another quick example from eighth grade of Lectio, Meditatio, and Compositio. This was from this year. It's not a particularly brilliant lesson, but it again reinforced to me how important it is to go through those three stages of collect, digest, and then create. So you would think after my experience of teaching Lord of the Rings to fifth graders, I wouldn't make the mistake of sending my students home with a packet of Augustine's Confessions, this, to read on their own, followed by this sort of quiz the next day. And yes, it was after a whole week of reading and talking about it and commonplacing it together, but from the amount of frantic and desperate texts I got the night that I assigned that reading, it was clear that my students weren't getting it. And yes, these questions are really easy, but I found Augustine challenging in high school and college, and these are just beginning eighth grade girls. Also, these questions are terrible. Name one experience of infancy mentioned by Augustine. This isn't what I want my students to be getting out of Augustine when their affections could be shaped by his beautiful portrayal of what love for God is, or how our hearts are restless until they find their rest in him. So to make a long, sad story short, my students bombed this quiz as a class. And even worse, those who got all the answers right didn't understand the reading, and they definitely didn't love it. And if I had shaped any of their affections, it was an affection for despising Augustine. And so here's what I came up with instead. And this is very simple. There are far more creative ways of implementing Lectio, Meditatio, Compositio. But what I did this time, repenting of the error of my first ways, was rather than give students several pages of Augustine to read, I gave them two paragraphs, basically one side of what you see here. And I gave them two whole class periods. I divided them up into pairs. And then they spent two whole class periods just working on analyzing their passages. And they took pages of notes. They drew pictures. They covered their passages with analysis. So that was the Lectio, the collection stage. Then for the Meditatio, the digestion stage, I gave them the assignment of preparing to teach a brief lesson to the class based on what they learned from Augustine. And we were in book 10, which is his book on memory and why memory is a virtue and necessary for being fully human and so on and so forth. And so I especially encouraged my girls to think about our own practices of memory. How do we as classical students go about memorizing? And this required them to go back over the reading they'd done, think about what it meant, how to communicate it to the rest of the class. And it was really amazing to walk around from pair to pair as they were working on this phase of the project. And I would hear things like, whoa, Augustine is so cool. And look at how he's talking about how our senses are the gateways to memory. And I can totally use this when I'm memorizing my Latin vocabulary or my history dates. And oh my goodness, this passage is so beautiful. And then for the meditatius stage, for the end of the meditatio stage and going on into the compositio stage, they taught their lessons on Augustinian memory to each other. And I was so impressed, not just by their depth of understanding Augustine, how much more they understood and how much more they had gotten from reading one paragraph in 2 hours versus 10 pages in one night. And not only were they able to communicate their deep understanding of Augustine to the class, but they did so using methods that Augustine said would help engage the memory, using emotions and word pictures and senses of smell and taste and touch. And they told me they loved it. Later in the year, they kept referring to, oh, Augustine was so much fun, because they felt like they were actually applying what they were learning in Augustine to something relevant, which was practices of how we do memory ourselves or understanding why memory is a virtue. And this continued to bear honey throughout the rest of our eighth grade year. As the girls built memory palaces to do their history homework and borrowed his philosophy of memory in their own lives. They all said that they wanted to reinvent the way classical grammar schools teach memory based on Augustine as well. And they also said that they love Augustine and they love deep reading now because of the way that we did this. So just to review really quickly, Lectio Collection was the deep reading and annotating the confessions. Meditatio was preparing the lesson about Augustine's philosophy of memory, and then the compositio, the part where it becomes fruit, was the incorporating those practices of Augustine's memory in our lives. And I've been really dreading teaching Augustine to junior high girls, but it was amazing to me to see how much the girls loved it because they understood it. And just the monumental difference between assigning reading in a quiz versus this liturgy of following collect, digest, and compose. But the other thing that I discovered is in order for this liturgy to be most effective for a particular lesson, I also needed to contextualize these practices in a whole day that was designed to shape affections. And in eighth grade this year, I realized my students are formed just as much by their experiences 5 minutes before class starts and 5 minutes after class ends. And it's possible for the liturgies of the rest of the day to undermine what's being communicated through following Lectio, Meditatio, Compositio, and the actual content of humanities. And I realized this was happening in eighth grade at the beginning of the year because we would get down to the last 3 to 5 minutes of class, and I would say, okay, we need to stop everything, rush, cram everything in your binders, and I would give rapid fire announcements, okay, don't forget that if you've fail this test, it's worth a fifth of your grade, and this project is really important, so study it so that you get an A. And by the way, there's a pop quiz tomorrow, and you want to make sure that you study for it so that you can get a good grade. And what I realized is that the liturgy of the way I was ending class was contradicting and undermining what I was doing in class. In our practices during class, I was saying, learning is about what you love, and then living it out. And in the last 5 minutes, my practices were saying that school's about cramming all the right things into your agenda, worrying that you got the homework agenda right so your grades won't suffer. Something I say to my students all the time is, you haven't learned this until you are living it. But as a teacher, I also have to remember they are learning what I make them live. And that includes what we're living together before and after the teaching of the lesson itself. And I realize that if it doesn't matter how much I'm shaping their affections in class, if I'm contradicting it by the liturgies I adopt the rest of the time. I'm still working out how to do this in an eighth grade classroom when I don't have the students all day long, but I did make some changes, especially to the way that we ended class. So I would stop 10 minutes before the bell rang and spend time just praying and singing and thanking God for what we had learned. And then I would give the students 3 to 5 minutes at the end of the day where I would just play background classical music and they would journal and write down things that they had learned that day and wanted to remember. And that way I felt like the practices I was using to end class weren't contradicting the practices that I was using to teach class. In fifth grade, this was a lot easier when I had all day with my students and could structure the whole day with a liturgical flow. So we had very set routines or liturgies or practices that we did first thing in the morning, then first thing after recess and at the end of the day. So every day after recess, we had a time of thankfulness where I would just go around the room and ask each student to offer a sacrifice of praise, share one brief thing they were thankful for. And then on Fridays, we would replace that with a toast where we would choose one student and give toast to just that one student. And the disposition that that cultivated in my students was an orientation toward gratitude in school. And just that little liturgy reinforced that to them. So our time of thankfulness was followed by a time of public class confession, where, especially after the little conflicts that come up after recess, students had the opportunity to ask forgiveness for each other individually and of the class as a whole. So they would stand up and say things like, please forgive me for being a ball hog during kickball, or please forgive me for losing my temper during our class discussion this morning. And so on and so forth. And if I had to name one best practice as a teacher from all my years of teaching, I would say it's this class confession. And this started when I realized, I'd been teaching 2 or 3 years at this point, and I realized I spend all day every day with my students. I'm a sinner. I sin all the time. And not once have I ever asked my students forgiveness for something. And rather than having that be the norm, we all need to see repentance and confession not just happening the few times a year a student gets in trouble, but rather that seeking forgiveness should be a habitual part of our lives. So daily class confession, I found, reinforced to the perfectionists that were trying so hard to do it all themselves and not need grace, and also to the students who felt like they messed up so much they were hopeless, that all of us are broken and deeply in need of Jesus. And then at the end of the day, we would sing the doxology with our hands raised, and then I would stand at the door, and the students would all pack up their stuff in their backpacks. They would line up at the door, and as each student walked through the door, I would turn to them, give them a little side hug, look them in the eyes, and say, "The Lord be with you," and they would respond, "And also with you." And these little liturgies came to be things that students absolutely loved and that really formed their overall experience and impression of class. And it was amazing to me to see how much they were affected by these little rituals. Every year I would fear that students wouldn't like it or wouldn't want to do it, would think it was weird. But every year I was amazed at the transformative power in their lives. One year, just a quick anecdote, this happened last year. I had finished dismissing and I left a kid named Ezra in the classroom because he was always late and he had only like a fourth started putting his stuff in his backpack by the time everyone else was done. So I was off down the hall talking to another teacher, completely forgotten about him, and I hear this little voice at my elbow saying, "And also with you, and also with you, and also with you," with increasing urgency and franticness. And I turn and I look, and there's Ezra, and he's standing there, and he's like, and I said, "Ezra, and also with you what? What are you talking about?" And he's like, "Mrs. Rollins, I can't leave. You haven't said the Lord be with you." And so I said, "Oh, Ezra, okay, the Lord be with you." And he smiled and relaxed, and off he went. And he just couldn't leave without that moment that I took to look in his eyes and send him away with blessing. We only have a few minutes left, so I'm just going to go through these very briefly. But in addition to daily liturgies, I've also inculcated practices to form students' hearts that structure all of our different routines, our beginnings and our endings, our mealtimes, our breaks, our passing periods, different traditions. One example of a yearly tradition is that in fifth grade, we would begin the year with an initiation ceremony to mark the beginning of the year, to say, you are beginning something new, something that's about changing who you are as a person. So we would have the students come up to the front of the class, they would sign an enormous charter, and then we would pray a prayer of blessing over them and have them recite a class promise. Also in fifth grade, another favorite regular practice was this, and this happened about once a month, that whenever I was reading a particularly suspenseful chapter to my students, I would have them bring pillows and blankets, I would make hot chocolate, and we would push all the desks and chairs to the side of the room, black out every little bit of light that could possibly come through windows with black trash bags. They were very meticulous about that bit. And then we would turn our flashlights on and drink hot chocolate and read Lord of the Rings or The Hobbit in the dark on the floor. And in eighth grade, similarly, every Friday we have what I call tea time, where I make tea and hot chocolate and apple cider, and we bring in cookies and little treats, and the girls make tea and drink tea, and then I just read to them for an hour poetry or whatever literature book that we're reading. And rather than being sort of extraneous and just fun, fluffy things, I found that sometimes it's these practices of sitting on the floor in a blanket in the dark with your flashlight or drinking tea while reading that really open the doors to students' hearts. And I really want to emphasize this. These practices are not just the fun and the fluff. I'm a very strict, hard teacher, but I believe that these practices are what open the door to making my students able to love Augustine and to love Beowulf and to love Lord of the Rings, even though they're just little fifth graders. And I could go into many other details, but I want to end here because of time. So the principle is that following this idea of lectio, meditatio, and compositio, and inculcating practices that structure both our days and our individual lessons, actually most shape students' affections. And therefore, these little practices, these things that we sometimes think as trivial, can be the difference between life and death. And Lewis comments on the gravity of what we think often as teachers are the trivial daily interactions in his essay on the weight of glory. And I've paraphrased this quote to make it about teaching students rather than people in general. But it really made me change how I approach my students and my practices to think about them in these terms. It is a serious thing to teach in a school of possible gods and goddesses, to remember that the most frustrating, rebellious, or boring student in your class may one day be a creature which, if you saw it now, you would be strongly tempted to worship, or else a horror and a corruption, such as you now meet, if at all, only in a nightmare. All day long, we are in some degree or another helping our students to one of these destinations. That terrifies me and sends me to my knees on a regular basis. It is with the awe and circumspection proper to them that we should conduct all our dealings with our students, our lectures, recesses, passing periods, lunches, classes, bathroom policies, lesson plans, discussions, discipline moments, grades, classroom decor, and parent-teacher conferences. There are no ordinary students. You have never taught a mere mortal. And on my next couple of slides, and I'll just close with this because we are at time, and I want to mention that this afternoon I'm also on a panel, has some long title about classroom integration or something, but the purpose of it is also for us to continue the conversation that we started here in this room. So you can come to that panel and ask me follow-up questions, even if they don't relate at all to Paideia or integration. So here are just some questions, and I'll go ahead and leave these up. I'm also happy to email them to you, but these are questions that I came up with for myself that I write at the top of my lesson plans to help me consider the practices that mold my students' hearts when I am planning my lessons. And I'll end there. Thank you so much.